is Marketing Over Coffee with Christopher Penn and John Wall.
Good morning. Welcome to Marketing Over Coffee. I'm John Wall. Today we have a special interview with Derek Sivers and our sponsor for this quarter, GoPromos.com. Custom promotional products at incredibly low prices, custom pens, water bottles, and of course, coffee mugs and more. The promo right now is GoPromos.com/MOC, $100 off your order of $175 or more, and that includes free shipping, but that's a limited offer, so you want to jump on that as soon as possible. So, Derek, thanks for talking to me today.
Hi, John. Thanks.
All right. So, you know, folks know you from CD Baby. And of course, our audience too follows TED a lot. So, that, you know, you're a TED speaker. I'm sure some of the folks listening have seen that. And now you're involved with the Domino Project. Your book, Anything You Want, is out now, available on Amazon. And we'll have some other links for that. But let's kind of start with the book. Kind of what got you into the Domino Project and why'd you decide you wanted to get a book out there?
I didn't really decide. It's funny, for years people would ask if I am going to write a book because I have these articles on my blog. And I always said, no. I have no interest in writing a book. I don't understand the point. People could just read my blog if they're interested. And so I always just said no. And I honestly, sincerely had no plan to ever write a book. But then Seth Godin calls me up and he says, Derek, I'm starting a new publishing company and I want you to be one of my first authors. Will you do it? And so, of course, I go, yes, sir, because he's my hero. So all of a sudden, I'm writing a book for Seth. So that's how it happened. It really wasn't a plan. But when Seth asks you to do something, you say yes.
Yeah, no, I can. That's a tough invitation to refuse there, especially if you're following, you know, kind of this marketing space. So the idea behind the book, one of the phrases you had for it was it's kind of a good, you know, a little more than 10 years of CD Baby experience packed down into like 100 pages. You have kind of your whole story there. But it, kind of one of the, you know, one of the big gotchas that jumped right out at me was you talked about the $3.3 million mistake. And I'd like to kind of get your side on that. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah. the lessons we learn the hard way, right? Like, I figured the most useful thing I can do with all of the mistakes I made in the last 10 years is to, for one, just kind of rub my nose in it to make sure that I really learn from my mistakes, but also to share all the things I've done wrong so that other people can perhaps recognize it in their own story and maybe it can be useful to somebody. So one little thing that I did wrong is way back in the mid-90s, there was a thing where it's like I borrowed $20,000 from my dad because it was before I started CD Baby, but I was trying to make my own record and everything fell through and everything like had gone horribly wrong, but I was so close to finishing it. And I asked if I could borrow $20,000 to finish it. And he said, yeah, sure. And with the best of intentions, he sent me some paperwork saying, just sign this and so, and I'll get my company to lend you $20,000. So I did it. And then many years later, I started CD Baby. And then years and years later, CD Baby was doing really well. And my accountant told me that my dad's company owned 90% of my company. And I said, huh? What do you mean? And he said, well, you don't know about this? Apparently there was some document you signed back in the mid-90s that selling 90% of your company to his company. I was like, no, I didn't. And he said, yeah, it was something about a $20,000 loan. I was like, oh my God, is that what I signed? So it turns out that like he had the best of intentions because at the time I had a little corporation I had set up, but it was worth nothing. It was basically this corporation set up around my recording studio. So his way of loaning me $20,000 was to buy 90% of my company for $20,000, but I hadn't read the paperwork and I didn't understand that. So yeah, the only way to get out of it I had to buy it back at market value. You know, the IRS watches those interfamily transactions very closely, so he couldn't just give it back to me. I had to buy it back at full market value. So I had to come up with $3.3 million to buy back my company from my dad's company. It was hard.
So that's, didn't really realize that that was completely pre-CD Baby. That was before everything had started with that then.
Yeah. So the joke, if you read the full version, the joke is that my decision to not make CD Baby its own corporation, but to make it a DBA on my existing corporation, really came to me from a bank teller. Like, I went down to the bank to say, I want to open a new business account. And she's like, oh, sweetie, you don't need to do that. You can just make it a DBA on your existing account. And I went, uh-huh, but it's a new business. She said, oh, don't worry about it. Just make it a DBA. It's much easier. And that one bank teller's advice cost me $3.3 million. So I guess the shareable lesson is watch out when people give you advice. You know, get a second opinion. Don't take everything too lighthearted, because even when you're just like small potatoes, you know, I was broke at the time, just making little $100 here and there. But that one little decision came back to bite me in the ass years later. So,
okay. So, well, of course, you know, you focus on your mistakes, but this is still at its heart, it's a huge success story. I mean, you were able to run this up and, you know, had perfect exit with it too. At the core, one of the topics you were talking about is just the idea of hell yeah, you know, getting the right idea. And if it's a hell yeah idea, if you could talk about that.
Yeah, this okay. This is one of my favorite philosophies in the world. I swear, I still use this every single day. The idea goes like this: whenever you're kind of trying to decide whether to do something or not, like somebody says, "Hey, do you want to go to this event?" or "Hey, can you can we meet over coffee and I'll pick your brain about something?" The idea is that we all have lives filled with so many requests and so many people that want us to do things, and I think most of us say yes to too much. But instead, if you set your bar higher and you decide, if I'm not feeling like hell yeah about this, like if I'm not feeling like, oh my God, that would be awesome. Whoa, that would be incredible. If you're feeling anything less than that, then just say no. And if you say no to almost everything, then you leave room in your life for that occasional rare hell yeah thing to come along. And when it does come along, you'll have all the time in the world to devote to it, because you've said no to all that other stuff that you weren't so enthusiastic about, right? So you can use this on a grand scale of like what kind of job should I get or what kind of contracts should I take or something. But even on the small little day-to-day level of like, you know, my wife and I still do this thing when somebody's asking us to go to some barbecue and it's far away and we don't even really know these people that well. It's like sometimes you feel that social pressure. You're like, oh, yeah, maybe we should. And then we just, you know, we even use it on each other. We're like, are we really feeling like hell yeah about this? No. So let's not do it. Okay, great. And then you just say no and all of a sudden you have spare time. And, you know, so I really think that most of us are overcommitted and that saying yes to less is the way out.
Yeah, that's interesting. You know, if we had like more than an hour, we could go even deeper with that. Because the thing that struck me about that is you see so much of that in kind of the sales and marketing end of things too, where, you know, people are afraid to say no. That's ultimately what it comes down to. You know, I mean, it's just whereas the sales guy would be much happier if you blew him off within 10 seconds so he could go pitch somebody else. But nonetheless, you both sit there and kind of do that dance. And I think it's a cultural thing. But
exactly.
So,
great point.
This minimalist thing, though, I see this as a running thread through everything you've done, because one of the great stories about CD Baby is that, you know, you weren't like the serial entrepreneur that this was your 35th company and, you know, 25 of them had failed and you got VC, you know, this whole like war march. This was really like you started with focusing on the customer first, and that drove you the whole way through. And again, because I think you had the hell yeah idea too, the idea was huge, so you didn't need all of that extra stuff pulling you along. But to kind of get to the meat of this and the question, of course, I guess, how do you feel that this minimalist thing works for you? And is this, did you apply that to business, or is this just kind of the way you live and that, you know, it went right along with that?
Yeah, I guess the minimalist thing, I do that in every aspect of life. But, you know, for whoever's listening to this, sometimes there's this thing, like you listen to an interview like this and you think that you're supposed to do whatever the interviewee is doing. So we could just as well have been interviewing somebody who is the opposite of that. They say yes to everything in their life and they own 7 homes and have 9 cars and, you know, 3 wives and 12 businesses. And you know what I mean? Like there's some people like that's to them, that's an exciting life and they want that. To me, that's like my idea of hell. Like, just personally, I love having the least amount possible. If there's something I'm not using in the house, I give it away to somebody who could use it. Like, I don't even like owning anything I'm not using. So, of course, like, in my business, anytime some well-meaning person would show up at the door with a clipboard telling us that we should have some kind of employee review policy or something, and posted terms of conditions on our website – my big question for them would be, like, will I be arrested and thrown in jail if I do not do this? And they'd say, well, no, it's not against the law, but it's really a good idea for you to have. Like, no. Okay, goodbye. We're done. Like, I don't want anything in my business that doesn't have to be there. If I'm not going to be thrown in jail for not having it, then I don't want it, you know? So, so even in like the way that I design my business, it just, you just have to get used to saying no to everything, because every other like B2B company wants to sell you something or wants to pitch you on their idea. You need to have their insurance plan and their this plan and that this and this and that. And everybody's trying to sell you something. You just have to get used to saying no to all of it. And it's the same thing with life. I mean, look at all the advertising we're bombarded with every day. Everybody trying to convince you that you really do need the iPad 2 because it's so much better than the iPad 1. And you just, you have to get used to just saying no to everything to find some kind of peace in your life.
Yeah, exactly. To escape the never-ending treadmill of it all.
Yeah.
So there's a great story in there, though, talking about, because even though you're talking about minimalist, too, there's also a core of personal responsibility there. And there's a neat story where you talk about the first employee who said, hey, I'm leaving CD Baby. I've got another opportunity here. And kind of, you know, where that went. Obviously, you get what I'm talking. We'd love to hear the story from you, of course.
Sure. Okay. Well, the background is, the last day job I ever held, kind of the first day job I ever held, I worked at Warner Brothers for 2 years from the age of like 20 to 22. Loved it. And when I decided to leave, that was like the last time I ever had a job, was in 1992, because I quit and devoted myself to being a full-time musician. And I did it, you know. So when I quit that job at Warner Brothers, I had such respect for my boss and the company and everything that I figured that if I want to quit, that's not their problem. It's my problem that I want to quit. So I had to go find and train my replacement. I just figured this is common courtesy. So I went and found somebody good, and I trained them, and I had them kind of come for a week and learn everything I did and show them everything I could. And at the end of the week, I went to my boss and I said, all right, I'm leaving today, but here's my replacement. Her name's Nikki. She's wonderful. I've known her for years. I've showed her everything, and she's ready to start Monday at my same salary. And my boss just kind of looked at me and went, okay, great. Send her into to HR. So I just kind of thought that that's the way that things are. I mean, that's kind of common sense, right? Like if you decide you want to quit your job, that's not your boss's problem. That's supposed to be your problem. You've decided you want to quit. So yeah, years and years later, now I'm the employer and I'm running CD Baby. And my first employee said he needs to quit. He's going to move to Tennessee or something. And I said, okay, congratulations. So who's your replacement? And he said, what? I said, well, who's your replacement? He said, I think that's your job. I said, really? And I went and found out, oh, oops. Like I just kind of naively thought that whoever's quitting, it's their responsibility to find their replacement. So I think it's kind of funny, this idea, like because I didn't go to business school and because I wasn't really trained in business, and in fact, I never even really meant to start a company, I was so naive in so many ways. But I think sometimes, you know, kind of like that Forrest Gump kind of idea, that sometimes being naive to the ways of the world helps you see common sense better than people who maybe have it kind of the ways of the world cluttered in their brain.
Okay, you had a great, there's a, you know, kind of, a, it's almost a pet peeve of mine, so this I definitely want to bring this to light, talking about punishing everyone for one person's mistake. A lot of businesses do this, and it's just part of that burgeoning bureaucracy, if you could kind of talk about that.
Oh, God. Okay. Well, I mean, it starts with just a typical coffee shop. I was living in New York City in Queens, and there's this coffee shop on the corner that it's filled with these signs. Like every time you're in there trying to eat, that you can't help but escape these big, giant shouting signs posted all around the store that are just like, absolutely no refunds for any reason. No shoes, no shirt, no service. Let's see, violators will be prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law. And all of these signs, I just kept looking at them thinking, God, this poor guy, like, you know what it seems like has happened is he's probably been here for like 20 years. And every time somebody comes in and does something wrong, maybe somebody is like demanding a refund and starts screaming, he thinks the way to solve it is he's going to go get a huge damn sign and put it up there so that everybody for all future time will now see that you can have no refunds for any reason. But the funny thing is, it made his little cafeteria, his little deli, like such an unpleasant place to be, because the rest of us who are not ever going to ask for a refund, it's like we're getting yelled at every time we walk in there. And then I thought of, like, there's so many businesses that do this. Like, they overprotect themselves so hard. Like, they make you agree to these massive terms and conditions on the rare condition that you might be that one person in a million that might try to sue them. So now all 1 million of you are going to have to sign this big legalese contract just so that nobody can try to sue us. And it's kind of this – there's this trend of it seems to only be getting worse. It's, I mean, it's like more and more people are kind of overprotecting themselves. This litigious society, we must cover your ass and treat everybody like a potential enemy just to protect yourself from that one that might be. And I think it's a horrible way to do business. And I think that especially if you're the business owner or you're somebody that's in control of your company's policies, if you reverse that and instead treat everybody with trust, and on that rare outlier person that may kind of try to screw you over, then deal with that person one at a time, but treat everybody else with trust. And I think you'll find that the growth and the trustability that comes with your business by treating everybody well will more than pay for itself for that one occasional person that's going to be a thief or whatever. Then you just deal with the thief, but don't bother everybody else with that. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, and it's, you know, with the technology we have now, at least you can kind of track the folks who are harder to deal with and make sure that, you know, they get a promotion to go to one of your competitors or something like that.
Exactly.
You know, you can do, but, you know, it's funny that they just, it's, you know, it's both that service thing and then just the cruft that builds up to it. Joel Spolsky has a great tale. He was talking about his dad and how it just takes his dad like 20 minutes to get out of the house, you know, because it's like he has to do the alarm and he has to lock the door and he has to check the door again because that one time he forgot, you know, and it's just, it's just like things build up over time. And yeah, if you can strip it down to the bare minimum, that's, you know, efficient and fast.
Well, you know, I'll give you one other quick example, because I think this is kind of important, that about a year after I started CD Baby, somebody came to me that it was thinking of starting his own similar website. And he said, hey, so which lawyer did you hire to do like your terms and conditions and privacy policy? And I said, well, I've never hired a lawyer, and I don't have terms and conditions and privacy policy. He's like, what? You need that stuff. You got to have that stuff. I was like, no, you don't. He's like, yes, you do, because if you don't – he said, what happens if some kid buys a CD from CD Baby and then kills himself, and then the parents are going to try to sue you and hold you responsible? What if that? I was like, well, if that happens, I'll deal with it. And some stupid link in the fine print on the bottom of the page isn't going to keep that from happening. Like, what? Come on. No, you've got to learn to say no to this stuff and like not try to like clutter your site with stuff that – you know, it kind of comes back to that hell yeah or no philosophy. It's like, are you really excited about having terms and conditions and privacy policy on your website? Well, then if not, then don't put it there. You don't need that stuff. I love that metaphor of Joel's dad kind of having to – it was filled his life with all these kind of like crufty habits. So you can just optimize your business like that too and just make sure that you're not filling your company with cruft that you don't – that nobody loves the fact that it's there. Then get rid of it.
Okay. So you've spoken at TED too. In fact, one of the classics, I don't know, maybe it was probably 2 years ago, maybe not long after you had done it, the first follower short that you did, which is fantastic. That just lit a fire, and we had plugged that already in the show. And it was funny, as I was doing research for this, I was like, oh, that's right, you had done the first follower thing. But kind of tell us about the TED experience and, you know, prep for that and, you know, just whatever comes to mind on that.
Sure. So, when I sold CD Baby, you know, most people, when it's like you sell a company like that, I mean, millions of dollars, whatever, you do something to celebrate, right? Some people will go buy a mansion or a Ferrari or a trip around the world or something like that. To me, I decided to go to TED because it's so expensive. It's like $6,000 to attend. And I was like, you know what? That's going to be my splurge. I didn't buy a car or anything else. I just started going to TED. So I went to 5 TED conferences in a row, and loved it. It was really, you meet some interesting people there. It's like the talks are inspiring. And just sometimes you just kind of feel cool, you know? I was like, I was waiting in line for the bathroom and Bill Gates is waiting behind me and Bill Joy walks out. And I'm just like, whoa, I love this. It was a little bit kind of, you know, what do you call that? Starstruck kind of stuff. So at the second or third one I went to, I gave a little talk called about the Japanese addressing system. I think on the TED.com website, it's called Weird or Just Different. But to me, it was about the Japanese addressing system and how it's a great metaphor for there's so many things in our life that could be the opposite of what we expect that work just as well in their opposite. So I was really kind of proud of that talk. And then the next time I went to TED, I had this little thing that I had posted on my website, which is there was this YouTube video going around of a guy dancing at a music festival. And at first it's just one guy dancing and then everybody gets up and joins him. And I watching that video, the first time I laughed and then the second time I was like, huh, that's actually a really good metaphor for everything I've learned about leadership and how to make a movement and, you know, books like Seth Godin's Tribes or Malcolm Gladwell's Tipping Point. It just felt like that was kind of like the visual metaphor for everything I had been reading about in those books. So I just went on my site and I wrote this little thing like, you know, notice that this is kind of like a movement. I mean, here it starts with this guy and then this guy joins in and then everybody, you know, such and such, and then the latecomers and pretty soon you have a movement. The funny thing is I posted it on my blog and nobody took much attention to it. But then, you know, when they were looking for TED speakers, I kind of offered to give this little 3-minute talk and they said, okay. And I got up on stage at TED and I did the same talk. And it's a power of knowing what audience you're speaking to, because that day, like over 100 different movers and shakers tweeted it. I mean, like people like Tony Robbins and Bill Gross from Blimco and all these people like tweeted it out to all of their followers about the first follower talk at TED and how it was one of their favorite things. And Peter Gabriel, to me, this was a highlight. Peter Gabriel, after I gave the talk, came running up to me. Like he was actually in conversation with somebody else. He sees me over his shoulder. He interrupts his conversation and runs up to me to say like, very powerful and profound and funny. That was really, really my favorite thing of the conference. Just absolutely wonderful. I was like, thank you, sir. So that was a real highlight to me. So it's funny. It was a little bit like it's like my hit single, which is funny because it was just such a lark, you know, I mean, just this one little talk I gave. But it's funny, you know, honestly, on a personal level, when I decided to sell CD Baby, it was a little scary because I thought, like, this is my one big achievement in life, and I will die, and my gravestone will say he made CD Baby back in his 30s, and that's all he did with his life. So it's kind of cool now that, like, as I go around the world, most people now seem to know me more from my TED Talks. And the question I get often is like, so what did you do before these TED Talks? I'm like, yes, that's awesome. I'm really glad that I'm known for more than just CD Baby. That's very heartwarming.
Yeah, right. Well, all right, so this is a good segue too, though, because so I've noticed over at Sivers.org too, you've got two other startups, things that you're working on, if you want to talk about that a bit.
Yeah, there's actually not much to say about that yet. They don't really exist yet. I just incorporated a few weeks ago. And I have this core belief that you never really know what a business is going to be until you put it out into the world. So anybody speaking in future tense about what their business is going to be is kind of moot because, like, for example, I thought CD Baby was just going to be a credit card processing service. That's it. And it wasn't until a few weeks after I launched that one of my first customers thought I was a store and he asked where my new releases were. I said, what new releases? What do you mean? I'm just a credit card processor. And he said, oh, I thought you were a store. And I went, ooh, a store. Now there's an idea. So all of a sudden, like just like that, my plan completely changed, you know? So I think there's no point in me talking about my future businesses because who knows what they'll turn into by the time I actually launch them.
I think that's probably a good point to wind down, unless is there anything else that you want to hit? Do you have any, you know, topics you want to run or points you want to revisit?
You know what? Yeah, I would like to just add one thing at the end. Some of the coolest people I've ever met in my life are the people who contact me after an interview kind of thing like this. Like they hear an interview, like I'm surprisingly easy to contact. And people often email me saying things like, I know you must be incredibly busy. I'm like, no, I'm not busy, because you know my whole kind of hell yeah or no philosophy. It's like, no, I actually say no to most things so that I do have room in my life to have interesting conversations with people. So I would just like to add, like, anybody listening to this, if you made it all the way through to the end and you think this is interesting at all, like, drop me an email and say hello, because I'd really love to hear what other people are working on. And yeah, just some of the coolest people I meet are the kind of people that listen to things like Marketing Over Coffee. So anybody, please go to my Sivers.org website and say hello and drop me an email.
All right, that sounds great. Yeah, I'll have links in the show notes too. I definitely do that. First follower, TED Pitch. Sivers.org/A is the site for the book where you can get information on where to purchase. And then there's also a promo with the book too. If you get the book, you'll get a code to get a bunch of songs, a bunch of music, free music from Derek. Is your favorites from CD Baby artists? Is that where those guys came from?
I kind of handpicked some of my favorite artists of all time and asked if... in fact, I didn't ask them to give away a song. I paid them $50 each to let me include their song as a giveaway to the book.
That's it. Well, great marketing for them, right? Just another venue to get it out there. All right, that's great. That'll do it for today. Derek, thanks for joining us. And until next week, enjoy the coffee.
Thanks.
You've been listening to Marketing Over Coffee. You can find Mr. Penn at blueskyfactory.com and read more at christophersspenn.com. Mr. Wall blogs at roanandmarketeer.com and appears regularly on the Bingcast. The Marketing Over Coffee theme song is called Melody by Funk Masters, and you can find it at Music Alley from Mevio or follow the link on our show notes.